A couple weeks ago, JJ kind of started us out on this training through teaching through some of the main concepts out of this book, Crucial Conversations, which has been, I think for me has been really helpful as someone who's very harmonizer-y, and it's hard sometimes for me to really engage these conversations. I tend towards like diplomacy in conversations sometimes, and so this has been really helpful, even just in thinking how to pastor people well, how to be a better husband, a better father, and engage conversations. And if you remember, JJ talked about what makes a conversation crucial is three kind of big components: opinions vary, stakes are high, and emotions run strong. And these are what we call crucial conversations. And we tend to either like avoid these conversations, or we face them, but we handle them really poorly. So those tend to be the two ditches we go to. And we fall for what the authors call the fool's choice, which is choosing between candor and kindness, between being honest or preserving the relationship. That's typically the two choices we feel like we have to have. And instead, JJ talked about how we need to strive for dialogue, for filling the pool of shared meaning. And so the big question through all of this, question I want to get to is like, how? How do we have this conversation? How do we engage it? And what's interesting is before we even get there in this book, the authors kind of have this section where they talk about, where they say, what do we do before we open our mouths? And it's really important because according to them, it's like our conversations, our crucial conversations, are often doomed before we even speak a word. And here's what they say about it. They say 70% of the success of crucial conversations, and I don't know where they got that. I think they probably made up that percentage. But according to their research, 70% of the success of crucial conversation happens in your head, not through your mouth. These skills that we're about to talk about are the prerequisites of success. Get these right, and the right words will often flow naturally from you. Ignore these, and no amount of technique or artifice will be enough to compensate. So we're going to talk about three skills that they kind of go through that I think is really helpful for us as we think about engaging these conversations. Three skills that are helpful before we even get there. Maybe we spot a conversation we need to have. Maybe we're thrown into one and we have a moment. These are the skills that we really need to grapple with. The first one, skill number one, choosing the right topic. Choosing the right topic. Have you ever been in a conversation where you wanted to talk about one thing and you walked away going, what the heck just happened? Right? It's like you talked about 20 different things and you leave going, I didn't talk about the one thing I wanted to talk about, right? So I think about this all the time when just hanging out with friends and you're talking and you stop for a minute and you go, wait, how did we get on this conversation? And why are we talking about how sandwich meat is round while bread is square? Like, how did we get here? Like, how did this conversation happen? And that's because human conversations are not linear, right? We jump around. We bounce from topic to topic. One thing brings up another thought, which brings up another thought. We cover a number of topics moving in and out. And that's just normal for any conversation. But when it comes to crucial conversations, that can actually be a really huge problem. And that's because crucial conversations are most successful when they're focused on one thing, on one issue, on the key thing that we need to talk about. And to maintain that kind of focus requires a lot of effort. Yeah. It requires a lot of effort from us. In fact, in crucial conversations where our emotions are running high, there's an increased temptation to shift focus. And in fact, in ministry, I would say we see this a lot. We see this a lot. Just imagine even, for example, as a pastor, you're wanting to talk to a husband about the issues he brings into his marriage. And what you're going to find out is as you have that conversation, the conversation begins to drift to his wife, his kids, his job, hobbies, the church, the news, weather, the government, a joke, anything, right? Anything other than what you're trying to talk about, dealing with the issue at hand. And we do that too. That's natural. Whenever there's something we're really uncomfortable with, humor comes out or some sort of distraction comes out. And so before we even open our mouths, We need to enter into the conversation deciding what we need to talk about and what is the right thing to talk about. And that's often easier said than done, right? And we tend to actually, we kind of default towards the wrong topic for a few different reasons. One is that we tend to choose easy over hard. We tend to choose easy over hard. And what I mean by that is when we're faced with a crucial conversation, we tend to focus on the argument we can win rather than what needs to be said, right? This is, I totally feel this because this is the diplomat in me, is it's like, hey, let's focus on what I know, where I know I can get a W instead of actually pressing into the issue that we need to press into. A lot of this flows from our fear of man, where we're choosing the easy conversation over the important conversation. Or here's what we do kind of with this. We try to say what needs to be said without actually saying it. We try to get people to come to the conclusion themselves. So we talk about other things, easier things, to get them to try to see the bigger picture. So instead of having a conversation with a group leader about why they shouldn't be leading, we talk about the minor ways they can improve communication skills or the other things they can work on in hopes that maybe they get overwhelmed enough to realize that they shouldn't be able, they can't do this. Instead of having the conversation that needs to have. But the problem happens, they rarely realize what they need to realize on their own. That often doesn't happen. The second thing is we tend to choose recent over right. We tend to choose recent over right. Is we tend to focus on the most recent behavior than what matters most, like a pattern or a lingering issue that's going on. So we might, in fact, we might put off a topic for a while that so long that we feel like we can't bring it up, right, without wronging that person. And so what tends to happen is we tend to look, we don't even realize we're doing this, we tend to look for recent things or things going on now to bring up the thing we should have brought up a year ago. And we inject that into the conversation and sometimes even shoehorn it into a problem that's not there. And so when we should say something like, hey, you may not remember this, but a long time ago you made a comment that felt like a personal attack and it hurt me deeply. Instead of saying that, the conversation becomes, earlier today you didn't listen to my input and that upset me. So we talk about the recent thing instead of really the root thing that we've been dealing with for the past year. And because the real issue hasn't been brought up, things are left unresolved. I mean, even in that conversation, the person may go, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you or disregard you or whatever. And now the real issue hasn't even been touched on. We haven't even talked about it because we're talking about the recent thing over the right thing. And the last reason why we tend to go to the wrong conversation is we choose unloading over precision. And here's what I mean by that. Instead of saying too little, we actually say too much. Maybe we've been holding on to several issues and we've reached a breaking point and now we unload every issue in the same conversation. So instead of talking about one thing, now we just drop 7 bombs on this person sitting across from us. We've unloaded everything we have on them when every one of those topics probably deserves their own conversation. And when this happens, we're just setting ourselves up for failure because people just can't handle that. People can't handle having 7 crucial conversations jammed in to one. Instead, we need precision. It needs to be using a scalpel and not using a chainsaw. So how do we choose the right conversations? Well, there's a few things, 3 things in particular, I think, that help us get on the right path to figuring out how we can actually focus on the right thing. The first one is pray. I know that sounds super simple, but it's actually really vital. In crucial conversations, we need God in the midst of us. We need him with us. In fact, he's in the conversation with us. We need the Spirit to guide us and to direct us. There's so many times, in particular with pastoral conversations, where I have completely misunderstood what's going on, going into it. I'm just completely wrong. I think I know the right thing to talk about, but then God actually guides and speaks and directs, highlights things in the midst of the conversation that's actually crucial and important in focusing on the right thing. The Spirit supernaturally reveals what the real issue actually is. And we need that with us. And in fact, we need to remember and always have an ear towards the Spirit in our conversations. God can guide us and direct us. God himself stands between us, changing hearts, speaking into the situation and guiding us. So we need to have an ear towards that. So we need to pray. The second thing we need to do is what the authors call unbundle. Unbundle. And what they mean by this is actually categorizing the kind of conversation that we should have. So there's a lot of different topics that we could talk about. And they try to, and it's not perfect, but they try to narrow down to this acronym of CPR to give us a bit of a way to categorize different conversations. So CPR stands for three things. First one is content conversations. Content conversations. These focus on a particular action and its immediate consequences. In other words, this is just the surface issue, right? So someone dropped the ball and they never followed up on your email. Sometimes, especially if this is the first time that ever happened, you just have to have a simple conversation to address what happened. You don't have to dive into the depths of their heart or what wounds they had as a child. Like, you may just have to tell them, hey, next time, can you email me? Right? Like, that may be all you need to do in that. Or a lot of times, we just have to clear up our own assumptions and take a step towards them. So we may not be seeing the situation clearly. And a content conversation is us going, hey, here's our perspective. Here's what we saw in this moment. Could you clear that up for me? Like, here's what I saw, how I interpreted that situation. And I just want you to speak into that. I want you to either confirm that, yeah, that's right, or explain to me what's going on. And that is a content conversation. The second thing, the P, is a pattern conversation. So if the same problem comes up more than once, you're now dealing with a pattern. A pattern. And when this happens, we actually have to address the pattern and not just the content of the particular situation. And so if we stick with the content conversation, the pattern is unlikely to change. So think about it this way. You have a kids volunteer who consistently shows up late on Sunday. I know none of us have that problem, but you have a kids volunteer who consistently shows up. You finally decide to talk about it. But instead of addressing the pattern, you address content. So you say, hey, John, you were late this morning. It's really important for you to show up on time. So what John does is he says, hey, I'm sorry I'm late this morning. My kid was sick. I was up late last night. I had car problems today. Whatever the thing is. And you go, okay, that's fine. The problem hasn't been dealt with because the pattern was never touched on. Yeah. It was never a conversation of here's what I see ongoing in your life. Here's this pattern that's creating a problem. And so patterns point to deeper issues, to matters of the heart. And if they're left unchecked, patterns become entrenched and they become more difficult to resolve. So we have content, we have pattern, and the last one is relationship. Relationship. As the problem persists, they begin to actually impact our relationships. Relationship conversations move to the realm of trust, competence, and respect. So in these conversations, we're coming to it recognizing we're relating to this person differently. Our opinion of their character and motive might be skewed. We're interpreting everything in light of this lingering issue. So maybe it's something like a year ago, you took credit for something I accomplished and it damaged my trust in you. I still don't understand why you did that. And I know Jesus calls us to reconciliation and I want to have a better relationship with you. These are conversations about our relationship and how we can work together, how we can love each other better. We're not just dealing with an unhealthy pattern, but now we're talking about the kind of relationship we want to have with one another. So they kind of use this CPR, and we often live in the content realm, right? So we often live in the what happened and how do we fix it, right? Just the bare issue, what do we do now? And the real topic is often much deeper than that. So I see this all the time. I get a lot of theological questions, questions about the Bible or things that come up. And sometimes it really is just that. It's just a theology question. Someone's curious about something. But a lot of times, the real question is way deeper.
Yeah, right.
It's the question behind the question. It's the personal experience that someone has felt, the hurt and pain that they feel. The way that this topic is somehow tied to another topic, very different than it. And so in those conversations, if you just dive in and start talking about, okay, let me just explain the theology, it's like you're actually not getting anywhere near where you're supposed to get. You have to do some discerning, some talking, some figuring out what is the real thing we need to talk about. And so one of the things that we need to do, we need to unbundle the conversation and figure out what conversation do we need to have. What's the priority here? What does Jesus want out of this conversation? How can we move forward with this? And then the last thing in choosing the right topic here is a really simple step. It's simplify. And what I mean by that is this, is boil down what you want to talk about into one sentence. Into one sentence. That helps you keep the main thing the main thing. This is often like, I've just learned this in preaching, in learning how to preach. It's like one of those things that I don't even know where it came from, but it's like, hey, the night before you preach, can you summarize your sermon in one sentence? And if not, you might not be ready to preach it. And in kind of the same way, as we approach a crucial conversation, it's helpful to just narrow things down to like, what is the one thing, the one sentence that sums up your topic? Now, there's an important caveat to this skill, and that's this, is that there are times where the conversation has to shift. There's just times where it has to. Maybe you discover a person just received a really bad medical diagnosis. Maybe in the midst of this conversation, you realize your volunteer's marriage is on the rocks. And there's a number of things that come up, and there are times where we have to shift. We have to love the person sitting across from us and recognize that we got to lay down what we're trying to come and talk about in this moment. And we need God's grace to help us know when to do that. And that's just a reality that sometimes we have to do. Now, when that happens, there's an important thing we can do, which is called bookmarking the topic. And what that means is we put a pin in it. So we say something like, even in a real rough situation, we're coming to it, we could say, man, I'm so sorry that this happened. I really want to continue our conversation some other time. But for now, how are you doing? You know, it's like, it's a way of saying, hey, we're not forgetting this conversation. We're recognizing we have to shift, but we're not forgetting the conversation we need to have because we still need to have that conversation. So before we open our mouths, we have to learn how to choose the right topic. Second skill we need to learn. Second skill before we open our mouths is starting with you. Starting with you. Before we have a crucial conversation, we have to start with ourselves and our own heart. And here's what we tend to do. We strangely think that we can be a neutral party in crucial conversations. That the only variable is how the other person is going to respond. And it's kind of like the analogy of like, we're trying to like show this video where we're the ones behind the camcorder videotaping. We're not in the picture. And it's like, actually, like we are a part of the picture. We're a part of the video. We have our own baggage, our own experiences, our own anxieties that we bring into the situation. And before we open our mouths, we have to own up to the ways that we've contributed to the problem. So JJ, last week, he mentioned lag time, right? So the time between noticing a problem and actually talking about it. Well, when we do that, we're actually contributing to the problem. We have contributed to what we're trying to address. In other instances, we've contributed to the problem with our own anxiety, with snarky comments that we've made, or with our own passivity. And before we point the finger at someone else, we have to recognize, examine ourselves and follow what Jesus taught, right? Matthew 7, why do you see the speck in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Before we open our mouth, we got to take Jesus' advice. We got to follow him, his commands. And we have to ask ourselves, how have we contributed to the anxious system? How have we perpetuated the problem? And when we fail to start with us, what happens is we end up injecting anxiety, brokenness into the situation. And we rarely help. And have you gotten into arguments where after a while, I don't know if this happens to you guys, where after a while you realize you're being ridiculous, right? No, okay, good. Right? This happens all the time. Like, basically every fight I get in with my wife, it's like after a while I realize I'm not making any sense. I have dug in. I'm like, I'm making the most illogical connections, like making up science and facts on the spot. Because like I want, because something has happened to where now I want to win an argument. Like, whatever intentions I had before, it's like, I want to win. So it's like, I'm like, I can't believe you said this. And my wife's like, I actually didn't say that. I think you misheard me. And I'm like, well, you should have used a different word. If you used a different word, I wouldn't have gotten mad. And it's like, it's so illogical. And it doesn't make any sense. But we might start off with good motivations, with good intentions. But here's what tends to happen. When the other person gets defensive, or the moment they attack us, or when things get testy, something happens inside our hearts. Our motives shift. We explode with emotion, right? We feel disrespected and we want to be proven right. Or we're angry and we want to get even. We're overcome with fear and maybe we just want to lie down, smooth things over, even if it's with kind of like a false peace. Why do we respond this way? Well, because we are driven by all sorts of desires and fears and experiences inside of us. Sin and brokenness have taken root deep in our hearts. And what happens is we end up blaming other people for our own emotions and for our own behavior. So we say things like, he made me mad. If she hadn't have done this, I wouldn't have responded this way. But here's the truth. No one can actually create emotions inside of you. No one can make you behave a certain way. Our emotions, our behaviors flow from our hearts, not from our circumstances. One of the most powerful things Jesus taught, I think, that's like all the time I'm trying to get in my heart, is when he says this, Mark 7, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. The problem is not out there. The problem is actually in here. The problem is in our own hearts. These situations are just stirring up and bubbling over what already exists inside of us. No one is creating anger in you. There is anger rising up inside of you. No one is bringing that out. And so when we come into a situation, into one of these crucial conversations where tensions are high, we have to remember that the only person we can change is ourselves. The only person we can change is ourselves. The only thing, we can't fix another person. We can't make a person do something. We can change how we approach the situation, and we can work on our own hearts and our own issues. We can work on ourselves. And we can aim to minimize the anxiety that we bring into the situation. And this is why we talk a lot about, like, we need to be a peaceful presence. A peaceful presence marked by the love of Jesus. And to do that, here's a few things that I think's helpful for us in that. First is having this, being marked by forgiveness. Being marked by forgiveness. As followers of Jesus, we should have a posture of forgiveness and reconciliation. It's nigh impossible to have a crucial conversation when we're overcome with resentment. And Jesus himself said one of the key markers of our faith, of being his follower, is radical forgiveness. And Tim Keller, he wrote a book on this topic, so it's way better than anything I would say. And he defines it, forgiveness, like this. And I think it's really powerful. To forgive is, A, to name the wrong truthfully as indeed wrong and punishable, rather than merely excusing it. So we acknowledge the truth, but also to B, identify with the perpetrator as a fellow sinner, to C, release the wrongdoer from liability, from personal payback by absorbing the debt ourselves. And finally, D, to aim for reconciliation and restoration of relationship that was broken by the wrong. All that to say, to be a peaceful presence, we can't come in harboring resentment and bitterness. We have to come in being able to release, to forgive. That doesn't mean everything's okay. That doesn't mean we pretend we weren't hurt or something bad didn't happen. But that means we're not seeking to get revenge out of here. We're not seeking to pay back. We're coming open-handed in that sense. Second thing is we need to recognize our feelings. And feeling emotion in crucial conversations isn't a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Emotions aren't a bad thing. In fact, emotions are good gifts from God that speak to us about our hearts. We're not robots. We shouldn't try to eliminate emotion. But where things can go wrong is what we decide to do with our emotions. Do we pay attention and respond to them, or are we propelled and ruled by them? And we have to listen. This is like basically the conversation I have with my kids every single day, which is like, hey, it's okay that you're mad at your brother right now. It's not okay to punch him in the face because you're mad at your brother. Like, feel it, but you got to learn how to deal with it. Like, you got to learn how to not hurt people because you're angry. And we have to learn the same thing as adults. Like, we feel anger, we feel sadness, we feel all these things. It's okay to feel those things, but those things are invitations to explore what's going on inside me. What am I feeling? Why is that the thing I'm feeling? Like, why, when she did this, I felt anger? Why? What's going on inside of me? We got to recognize those things and name those things, and then we can move forward in a peaceful presence. Otherwise, we're just going to be driven and ruled and propelled by our emotions. We're going to react instead of respond. So we need to recognize our feelings. We need to pay attention to our motives. Our motives are never entirely pure, but are mixed and twisted. And we may want the right thing, but our hearts are just bent. They're bent towards idolatry and sinful desires. And in crucial conversations, we have to remind ourselves what Jesus wants out of the conversation. And those shifts can happen like that. Those twisted motives can happen so quickly, and we have to grow and be aware of that so we can catch ourselves when that happens, right? Like, that's one of the most helpful things in my marriage, is being able to catch myself when it's like, now I'm just digging in. Like, now I have to actually humble myself and go, you know what? You're right. I'm not making any sense. And the last thing, we need to be transformed by the love of Jesus. None of this can happen if we aren't being transformed by the power of the gospel. And as we recognize our own brokenness, but also the depths of the love that God has for us, we're actually able to engage these conversations in love and grace. The sinfulness of other people aren't going to surprise us, right? Or offend us. Hopefully, we actually begin to see others in the way that Jesus sees them, with mercy and compassion in our eyes. So we need to start with ourselves. We need to look at ourselves. We have to remember we're the problem. Like, we're bringing problems into the situation. And if we work on ourselves, we actually can be a peaceful presence as we engage these conversations. So the last skill number three, before we open our mouth, is we need to interrogate our stories. We need to interrogate our stories. In every situation, There's a story we tell ourselves. And stories are powerful. Stories grip us. They shape the way that we see everything. But we tell ourselves stories like, they don't care about me. If I married someone else, I wouldn't have this problem. He's a misogynistic jerk. Like, these are all stories, our perspectives, the way that we're seeing and now interpreting a situation. And these stories often go beyond bare facts as we're making assumptions about others' motives and intentions. And even though we'd like to believe we're really unbiased, we're not. We're just not. We're actually all of these stories are enmeshed with our past, with our desires, with our fears. They might even be the result of lingering wounds that affect us in the present. And just like with feelings, it's not bad to have a perspective. In fact, you will have a perspective. You will. And sometimes you're going to be right. Maybe you are dealing with a misogynistic jerk. But the problem is when we wholesale believe our perspective without self-examination or wisdom. And we tend to use these stories to justify our own foolish behavior and reactivity. Well, of course I unloaded my anger on that critic. He's such a bully. He's never going to learn until he gets put in his place. I did him a service by tearing him down. We turn our sin into righteousness, into justice by the stories that we tell. So before we open our mouths, we actually have to question our stories and try to discern what is the right story. So a few things to help us to do that. First thing is spotting our story. What are you telling yourself about this situation? And again, you have to be brutally honest here. We'll tend to want to kind of like not, even with ourselves, be honest about what we're seeing and feeling. We have to be brutally honest. We have to look at the way we're acting and feeling. And if you can, here's what I like to do with this. Try to actually just say the story out loud if you can, because you will realize how dumb it is. Okay? You will realize how dumb it is. Like, literally yesterday, I got frustrated with my wife. And in myself, I was like, why am I angry? And I'm like, well, I don't understand why she did that. I'm like, I'm angry because I don't understand something? That doesn't make any sense. Like, people don't get angry when they don't understand. What's going on deeper in here? You know? And so we sometimes saying it out loud just helps us pinpoint, like, actually, even what I think is a story is not the story I'm telling myself. What really is going on here? Why am I feeling this way? What am I telling myself? So we need to spot our story. We need to separate fact from story. And the second thing, we need to separate fact from story. A lot of times we think our perspective can be black or white, but more often it's like they're either more accurate or less accurate instead of just right or wrong. But to us, they feel like facts. We tend to think there's no other way to look at things. And we have to ask ourselves, can you see and hear this thing that you call a fact? Is there evidence for it? Is it specific, objective, and verifiable? Now, maybe if it's not, it might be true. It might not be true. But we have to interrogate these stories that we have and try to actually separate what is an interpretation I'm making and what's a fact. And so we might think through something like, man, I can't believe Bob got the job I wanted, right? I mean, I've been wanting this job forever. I've worked my tail off. God knows how much I wanted that role. And now it just feels like a closed door. What did they see in Bob that they didn't see in me? There's all kinds of stories enmeshed in that and interpretation in that. There's very selective things that we're seeing in those stories. And in stories we tell like this, you can kind of separate facts from stories sometimes by seeing like, are we imposing motives? Are we making assumptions? Are we taking personal offense to things? Like, what actually happened? instead of just embracing our stories and reacting to it, let's pull back to fact, to the things that we know are true. And a lot of times, we actually end up leaving out important parts of the story to try to make sense in our minds how we're feeling. And so this step's really important because if we actually separate out facts from story, it can turn down our emotions a little bit. When we're like, okay, I don't know that that person was actually out on a personal vendetta against me. Like, there could be 100 things that happened. I don't know. And we can approach the conversation in that spirit. Actually, that turns things down a bit to like, now I want to bring things and have a conversation. I want to know what's going on and be open to receiving more information so I can tell the right story. It makes us a bit more level-headed. Third thing here, we need to watch for clever stories. So the authors of the book, they identify what they call three clever stories, which are ways of self-justifying our behavior. And these stories are rarely true, and they often flow from our own twisted desires. So the first one is victim stories. It's not my fault. And these stories make ourselves out to be innocent sufferers who are experiencing injustice. But in these stories, we often don't recognize how we are contributing to the problem. When we tell victim stories, we conveniently leave out parts of the story that may reflect negatively on us. So maybe you've been distracted at work and your boss points it out as an edge of growth, but now you respond defensively. You think your boss is out to get you or to just put you down or some sort of personal offense that you take to it, as if you have been misrepresented without recognizing actually you've been distracted. The victim stories, it's not my fault. Second, there are villain stories. It's all your fault. These stories make others out to be irredeemable villains. You'll notice these stories by the names we use. Control freak, bonehead, idiot, jerk, snake, bad words, right? Fill in your bad word. Because those are not the words I use. Those are the words I was like, how can I make this PG? But what we do with these words and in villain stories is we dehumanize people. It's easier to hate an entity or a name than it is a person who has actual feelings and emotions and family and friendships that are not all terribly bad. Finally, there are helpless stories. There's nothing else I can do. In these stories, we convince ourselves that there isn't a healthy path forward. So in other words, we have to yell or we have to be silent. There are no options left. And these stories take God out of the equation. It's all on us. We have two options. None of them are good. God can't move in this at all. And the last thing we need to do to help us in interrogating these stories is to tell the rest of the story. There are often parts of the story that we're leaving out, missing details that paint a fuller picture of what happened. So we could turn victims into actors by asking, what am I pretending not to notice about my role in this problem? That's a good question. Right? What am I pretending not to notice about my role in this problem? We can turn villains into humans by asking, why would a reasonable person do what I'm seeing right now? Why would they do that? Are there other explanations than that they're evil? We can turn the helpless into the able by asking, what can I do right now to move towards a solution? And how can God meet us in the midst of this? And one last thing I would say on this before we wrap up is one thing that I think is helpful in the appropriate context is And what I mean by that is, like, when you actually have the relationship to do it, is to actually share your story with the person. Like, one thing that's been helpful for me and my wife a lot is to come, we actually started doing this really early in our marriage, is to say, hey, listen, I'm going to tell you my perspective, and I'm not saying it's right. I just need to tell you, here's what I'm seeing. And I'm inviting you to speak into it, and I'm going to receive what you're telling me. So when you did this, I felt like you were being this way. And that helps us take it down, because whenever we point fingers and say, you did this, it flares a lot of stuff up. And sometimes we just have to come and say, here's how I received that. Here's what happened. Can we work towards a solution together? I'd like to hear what your perspective was in that. So in the appropriate context, sharing those things. So three things: choosing the right topic, starting with us, and interrogating our stories. So before we get out of here, I want to spend some time praying for us that God would actually meet us in it. But I'd love to just open it up for any thoughts, questions you guys have, anything that some of you guys want to add, like Kevin or Josh or whoever.
I feel like you and JJ both said this.
Yeah.
And it bears repeating multiple times. James 4 gets at the root of conflict, right? Mm-hmm. We want stuff and we don't get it, so we murder.
Yeah.
What causes strife among you? You desire things and you don't have them. I wanted your respect. I wanted that to be easy. I wanted to be acknowledged. And I don't get it, or it didn't even go the way I wanted it. And sometimes we're not even aware of the ways we wanted it. We just know that we didn't get our expectations met.
Yeah.
So we are literally like walking around as crucial conversation generating machines, which are conflict generating machines.
Yeah.
And if we want to honor Jesus well and see renewal happen in the city, we actually have to pay attention to this, because we have an obligation to Jesus himself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've seen is gospel-centered churches, the churches that are most excited about celebrating the supremacy of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus in everything, suck the most at this.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because we want to spiritualize stuff away, or we want to just like make the gospel be this intangible answer that we just like paste on stuff. Mm-hmm. But this gives us the opportunity to really ask how God is good for us in all these places. It's like the gym for the gospel.
Yeah.
In relationships.
Yeah.
And I'm blessed hearing you teach it. I was blessed hearing JJ teach it. I went back and listened to his audio the same day, and I'll do the same thing with you today if he sends it to me. Having walked through a church that got split and rent asunder and fragmented, mm-hmm. there's nothing more important to put on the table than this, and it's not a technique.
Yeah.
It's like, how do we actually operate in the centrality of the gospel in relationships where stuff hits walls, which happens all the time?
Mm-hmm. So good.
So I'm just sitting here like humbled and thankful and praying for Frontline and praying for Oklahoma City, because people don't know how to do conflict, and
yeah.
we have this central reality that enables us
yeah.
to do it without fear or hesitation.
Yeah.
But we're either like afraid, or we spiritualize stuff, so we don't do it.
Yeah.
Christians alone have the tools to really navigate conflict beautifully,
yeah.
and more often than not, we run away from it.
Yeah. yeah. It's good
so
work.
This matters.
Yeah.
So good.
It's a mind-blowing concept that something out there is not creating all the feelings in here.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for a guy that's grown up with a lot of feelings. It's bizarre. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about, like, and you touched definitely mm-hmm. like, how do we slow down enough to go, like, this person or this thing is not creating this intense emotion in me? How do you slow
mm-hmm.
down enough to look at it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I think it's really difficult. I know for me, just personally, like, I'm not crazy emotional, but when I feel emotions, they overwhelm me. I explode with emotion. Which makes me very uncomfortable, because I don't know how to deal with it. And I get, even in reading some of this stuff, it's like, oh yeah, I resonate that, where it's like, I literally lose my brain in the midst of these conversations. And I think what's helpful, I mean, I don't know, I think it's just like with everything, it takes time, intentionality, and work. Like, I feel like all the emotional stuff, at least for me, I mean, maybe other people, it's different. It's like, it takes a lot of work for me to even recognize what I'm feeling. And like, it helps me that I have relationships where people press me to name it, because it gives me the skills to do that. Where it's like, they don't let me just get away with, like, I'm upset. And it's like, well, what do you mean by that? Like, what does that mean? Like, what's upset? Like, are you feeling angry? Are you feeling sad? Are you feeling, like, and so some of it's even just, like, growing in our emotional IQ of just, like, knowing how to name what we're feeling. Because some of the problem is just that. We don't even know what we're feeling. We're just feeling and acting. And we're not even thinking about, what is this feeling? You know, and sometimes we get confused where it's like, we think we're angry when we're actually just really sad. You know, it's like, there's things like that, that it's just like, so I think one thing is just like growing and knowing how to name what it is that we're feeling. Because I think that gives us a bit of, it gives us a bit of perspective and control over it. Because then we can start diving deeper into the questions of, why am I feeling that? You know, like, why is, like, that's the question I ask myself all the time. It's like, why, when this situation happened, why do I feel angry about that? Like, that's not necessarily a reasonable response to that. Why do I feel angry about that? And a lot of times that does deal with, like, deeper wounds or things that you've experienced in the past that you have to work through on your own. So I think it's just, I think it's hard. I think we have to do a good job about recognizing when we're overwhelmed with emotion and we just need to step away. Like, and times where we just have to say, hey, I need a moment to calm down. Like, and not that I want to be done with this conversation. I just need a moment to gather myself. Because there's times where I realize, like, I'm losing all control and thought and just everything. I just need a moment to gather myself. And then I can ask myself, what's going on? Yeah. You know? So I think a lot of it is just even just doing the work yourself, figuring, being able to name what you're feeling, recognize what you're feeling, pinpoint some of those things. Because then, too, once you do some of that, it's like, what I've noticed for myself is, like, one, now that I can recognize it a bit easier and recognize where it's from, it helps me understand myself a bit better. And it helps me be able to go, it's like, oh, I'm actually not dealing with what my wife did right now. I'm dealing with what my dad did 20 years ago, you know? So let me have a little bit of grace on her and see that a bit better.
Something Josh said a few years ago was like a light bulb moment for me. I grew up in a home where it was never asked, like, what do you feel? So I kind of, like the guy that needs a chart and a graph to go, like, it makes me feel, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of my level of emotional intelligence. So Josh said this thing that was just like, it's so simple and helpful. Just the need to separate out your thinking versus your feeling.
Mm.
A sociopath has those, like, a chasm. Their thinking and feeling is completely separated out. But often the problem is that ours are way too enmeshed.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally what I've had to do, like, literally what I do is before hard, hard, intense, emotionally driven conversations, I'll sit down and I will literally write out, here's what I think and here's what I feel. Mm-hmm. And it gives me a chance to just evaluate the list and look at how much of what I'm feeling is actually driving me. And that's just one of those very simple tools that has helped me slow down and really come to a better grip. It's not that my feelings are invalid, but they certainly shouldn't shape how I act towards this person.
Yeah.
Which I literally carry in my phone. I pulled it up, and that's JJ, if you guys know this. There's a book written several years ago. It's one of the most poorly written, best. If I can explain that. No, the book is called The Voice of the Heart by Chip Dogg. Have y'all read this?
Yes.
It's the most terribly written book of all time, but it's a really important book.
Why do you hate it so much?
I love it. I might even go as far as to suggest that the reason why you guys have read it is because I gave it to someone else years ago. I love it. But I carry Chip Dogg's feelings chart in my pocket all the time.
Yeah.
And because so often we say, I feel like, and the second you say like, you're talking about what you're thinking, not what you're feeling. Or I tell my kids all the time, confused isn't a feeling.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah. What am I actually feeling? I'll just do this before the Lord and then ask, what opportunity do I have in this moment to draw near to my Father or to run away from Him?
Yeah.
So what's the invitation for me in a feeling? And where could I respond to that sinfully? Like, where, if I have two doors in those moments.
Yeah.
So that, really good. That's what I do all the time.
Yeah, that's really good.
And it's like, I feel like I'm 6 years old. Well, that's not a feeling.
Yeah.
But I'm not afraid to say, okay, I lack skill here. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put the training wheels on the bike of my life and just look at this and go, oh, that's anger.
Yeah.
I'm calling that something else, but actually that's anger. That's shame. So I have an opportunity to draw near to God and be humble here instead of something else.
Yeah, I love that too, because I think that book's helped me actually give some language to stuff. Again, I think anger is one of those things, it's like, it's hard to name that sometimes when you're feeling it, and we have all kinds of other softer words for it, of like upset, frustrated, annoyed, or whatever, and it's like, actually, I may be feeling angry, and that feels wrong sometimes, or like shameful, or like whatever, and it's like, actually, I have to own that. Like,
well, if you talk to guys that have been impacted by Chip Godd deeply, they'll use anger as a really positive term. You know, they'll say, how's your marriage? I'm like, man, thanks for asking. I'm just angry enough to ask. I'm like, that's weird. What they're saying is it matters.
Yeah. Absolutely. So good. Well, guys, it's past noon, so I want to get us out of here. Let me pray for us. Jesus, God, I pray that you would shape us and shape our church to be a people that can engage in these conversations in a way that honors you, in a way that is flowing from our hope in the good news of what you've done, in the gospel, in your grace, and in your forgiveness. And Jesus, would you help us grow in the ways that we need to grow? God, would you help us to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves, with what we're feeling and thinking, with how we're seeing things? And God, I pray that you would just, even out of us talking about this, that you would bring up conflict that's been long standing that actually gets resolved because of these conversations and because of our work here, Jesus. Would you help us to be a people who can sit across the table, look each other in the eyes, and have hard conversations, and in a way that is loving and filled with grace and with truth? So Jesus, we just invite you into this. We need you. Holy Spirit, would you guide us and speak to us? Would you highlight the conversations we've been putting off that we need to have? And God, we need you in the midst of us. It's your name we pray. Amen.